The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Just by way of orientation here, does everyone have a plan or a map? Should have a two-sided map. First, I'll give you a sense of your environment. Just across the street is the Parliament Buildings, Westminster. And in the Parliament Buildings, you, of course, have the House of Lords, House of Commons. They summon this assembly. You also have other good things. There's a few bookshops there. You have three pubs, Heaven, Hell, and Purgatory. And given that the average Englishman drank 7 pints of beer a day in the 17th century, that would be an important part of the life of a Westminster divine. Just over here to your left, we have a boys' school, which is noisy and repeatedly. We're trying to eject them out of the Abbey because they keep running in and making noise, and that is a problem. There's also a prison just outside the door, and beggars in the cloister. Whenever we're walking around, there's a problem with beggars. And there is the odd rascal that hangs out in the Abbey at night. One of them has an axe, but he is caught, and there are wild dogs. So that's your general environment outside the Abbey. Now, if you have the plan of Westminster Abbey in front of you, at the very top you'll see that's Henry VII's chapel. That's where we'll be today when we discuss justification. That's where the assembly first meets. And then it moves, when it gets a little bit too cold, about this time of year actually, down to the Jerusalem chamber, which is in the very bottom. It's a small chamber, but it's equipped with tiered seating. So you can fit, on a good day, about 100, 120 people in the room. There are committee meetings. H is the Jericho chamber. It's a small room. Committees meet there. Committees meet in the deanery by I. Committees may meet in that wagon wheel structure near the top of the page, B. And then very strangely, they meet over in the north transept, which is on the left-hand side of your plan. At C, if you go to the Abbey now, you'll just see a great clutter of monuments and gravestones there. But at the time of the assembly, the area was fairly empty, although cold and drafty. So that's the plan of Westminster Abbey. Now, if you flip your page over and look at the conjectural seating plan in the Lady Chapel of Henry VII, that's where you are today. There are a couple different ways to enter the chapel. You have your two doors over there. This room sort of suffices as Henry VII's chapel. And then you have a grand door right in the center, which is usually kept closed, and you can see people through the grate if they're trying to eavesdrop or be subversive in any way. Then around us, we have 100 carved saints on the walls to encourage us, the bodies of kings and queens below us on the floor. In the center of the room are pews that have been installed to hear sermons and for the sake of the assembly. And on the side, we have the lords and the commons. You are the lords and the commons on each side. You don't really say very much at all. You do ask us to hurry up every once in a while. And John Selden makes contributions. And although his friends lionize him and say that he's a great disputant in the assembly, he's usually ignored and he's often wrong. And the divines seem to realize that. Now, in the center, I've figured out in the spring where people actually sit in the Jerusalem chamber, but I don't know where they sit in Henry VII's chapel. But if the clusters of friends stay roughly, if there are parallels between the different clusters of friends in the two buildings, then right in the front here, we have very well represented, as is always the case in the front of buildings, we have all the oldest and best educated members of the assembly. Many of these belong to the powerful first committee of the assembly. There's three standing committees, and most of the educated men and the older men and many of the best theologians are in the first committee. Then behind, at the very back, we have the troublemakers. You are people who often vote against the majority. You have a different sort of hermeneutic than the rest of us. You really like proof texts for things. And you really do not like any high churchism. You do not like fixed liturgies. You do not like forms or creeds. You sit near the door, perhaps sometimes because you come late, certainly because you don't want to be near this group up here, and you like to observe what's going on elsewhere in the room. In the middle, we have people who are actually really quite marginalized, but don't wish to feel marginalized. So they won't sit at the back, but they won't sit at the front either. That's a bunch of independents and their friends. So there you are. That's our I'm William Twist. No, the provocateur would stand in the middle, and then either side you would, or he would sit in the middle, on either side you would have an assessor. In Henry VII's chapel, they're either just behind him or just in front. And Mr. White, as usual, is sick, so he's not here. So that gives you a basic orientation in terms of the physical shape of our room and our environs. Well, as Roland Ward has explained, the Westminster Assembly was summoned by the Long Parliament during the English Civil War. And to the extent that religion was a cause of the war, this Assembly of Divines was supposed to be a solution. As the two houses sought, the gathering was to produce documents for the church that the king and his Puritan subjects would all accept. And simultaneously, the assembly showed Edinburgh that Westminster was serious about church reform. And that served as an inducement for the Scots to send an army southward to help the flagging parliamentary cause. Because in the summer of 1643, the English parliamentarians were losing the war against the king. Now, the assembly got off to a slow start. In fact, it had five false starts. And even on the sixth try, Parliament's summoning ordinance for the synod was misprinted three times. And the theological members of the assembly, who were all chosen by Parliament, were given less than a week's notice to make their way across the country, across battle lines, to the capital. When the synod finally met on the 1st of July, 1643, for William Twiss's opening sermon, more people showed up to watch the event than Parliament had anticipated, so they had to move the event from Henry VII's chapel into the nave. But even then, once the fireworks fizzled, Parliament had to ask the divines to go home and return a few days later, for the two houses had still not decided what the Westminster divines were actually supposed to do. Now, the general mandate of the gathering was stated in Parliament's summoning ordinance, and it involved the settling of the government and liturgy of the Church of England, and the vindicating and clearing of the doctrine of the said church from false aspersions and interpretations. Now, in spite of the compound nature of this charge, the reigning historiography, the reigning way of telling the story about the assembly for the past two centuries or more, has focused almost exclusively on the assembly's debates over church governance. Now, important new material has come to light since Robert Paul wrote his important history about the assembly almost two decades ago. Most of the assembly's manuscript papers have been located, and a typescript of the synod's minutes, a three-volume record of speeches and motions and resolutions, has been created. Furthermore, a lost journal by John Lightfoot has been uncovered, and that fills a crucial two-month gap where we really knew nothing about the assembly, or very little. And so collectively, these documents, especially those narrating the early history of the gathering, place the assembly's work on a new footing and suggest that our understanding of it is incomplete. For instance, a systematic analysis of the assembly's 1,333 plenary sessions, 210 ad hoc committees, and 162 documents indicates that the near exclusive focus of historians on the assembly's ecclesiological debates has given us a distorted and partial picture of the synod. For instance, Robert Paul's 500-page history of the assembly spends 495 pages discussing church government and about five pages on other matters regarding or other matters of the assembly. But the assembly itself devoted only a quarter of its time to the subject. So viewing the work of the divines from the perspective of the assembly's own history and not from the position of parliamentary history or of genealogical backgrounds of modern denominations such as Robert Paul's Congregationalism. Theological reform emerges as the high-ranking item on the assembly's own agenda. Now, as important as theology was to the divines, it finds almost no place in histories of the assembly. And the general aim of this lecture is to begin filling this historiographical hole by examining some of the assembly's deliberations over just one theological locus, the doctrine of justification. Now, this paper addresses questions raised by a new generation of scholars, including Richard Muller, Willem van Asselt, Carl Truman. A major task of their revisionist project, as Richard Muller has stated it, is simply identifying who were the major figures and what were the major issues in debate, and then sufficiently raising the profile of the figures or issues in order to bring about an alteration of the broader surveys of the era. So the first object of this paper is to identify possible major figures. What the revisionist project does on a vast scale, using published works of individual thinkers, most of them continental, I'm going to attempt here on a very small scale, using the manuscript papers of a synodical gathering, the members of which were largely British. So in this paper, I'll narrate only a few mornings of debate. It says a day at the assembly. That's not quite fair. It's actually a morning and a half, not a full day. But I hope that in this case, the small scale of the study will give us the luxury of studying one debate under the microscope in near laboratory conditions and enable us to focus on details in this post-Reformation synod that a drive-by tour of the assembly would surely miss. Now, in the assembly, in the assembly's debates, we have access to the opinions, especially this justification debate, which I'll discuss today. We have access to the opinions of a significant number of divines whose own sermons and writings on the subject of justification did not survive. Both John Lightfoot's journal and the minutes of the assembly record the individual speeches of the divines, and together these sources indicate that the debate on justification was really quite well attended. 52 people spoke one or more times during the debate, although only 44 actually spoke to the question. That body of 44 theologians provides historians with a wider than normal cross-section of mid-century opinion on the topic of justification. 12 of these divines left published or manuscript comment on the topic of justification. 32 did not. Now, perhaps this debate in the Abbey then can tell us something of the post-Reformation world and its people that published works cannot. That's major, identifying major figures. The second and related inquiry of this paper is about parties. I've argued elsewhere that the assembly divides along non-ecclesiological lines when debating non-ecclesiological issues, such as the ecumenical creeds. In the telling of this debate, this line of inquiry is continued. Are there new party divisions in the assembly when new loci are under discussion? The third thing we'll look at is that it's a commonplace among Civil War historians to note the importance of, say, military or political forces and their impact on the assembly, the assembly's debates usually over church government. And we'll ask if there are other important forces outside the assembly and whether they affect the gathering's theological debates. And then finally, the study inquires into the nature of theological construction. Are there primary concerns in the forefront of these divines as they are, in this instance, altering the 39 articles? Are there word choices determined by political or pastoral or polemical dimensions or some combination of the above? Some of these questions will be raised from time to time in the telling of a story. All of them will be addressed at its conclusion. Well, Parliament finally decided that the initial assignment of the Westminster Assembly was to be the revision of the 39 Articles. And three standing committees involving all the members of the Synod were assigned different articles and met every afternoon to prepare reports. These reports were then brought in during the morning plenary sessions, where 60 to 100 theologians were in attendance, with 30 political observers, sometimes 40, sometimes 20. And the divines spent July and August discussing the first 10 articles. And on the morning of the 5th of September, the chair of the first committee reported on Article 11, which you'll find in your handout, recommending 9 alterations to the original article of the justification of man. The first alteration proposed by the committee, that's the first committee, was the addition of the phrase "in the sight of God" to the existing title of the justification of man. And you can see the proposed text of the committee. Then, citing the threefold use of the term justification as a possible source of confusion, the committee thought that the new addition to the title would show what is here spoken of. The committee held that the term justification was used 3 ways in Scripture. First, as a justification in the sight of God by the atoning work of Christ, and they instance Romans 5, verse 9, as an example of that. Second, as a justification in the Christian's own experience through faith, and they mention Romans 5, verse 1. And third, as a justification in the sight of others by the works which flow from faith, James 2, 24. Article 11 concerned itself with the second of these usages of justification, that is, justification in the Christian's own experience through faith, and the title, the committee thought, should reflect that. One of the committee's recommendations was to emphasize more heavily that salvation was not by works, so that primo intuitu, a papist that looks upon this article, might see their doctrine condemned. Now, old Henry Wilkinson sought to do one better by placing a full definition of justification in the title itself, apparently so that any Roman Catholic who opened a copy of the 39 Articles, and if he came to the 11th article, he would immediately be confronted with the true doctrine of justification without having to read the article itself. Now, undoubtedly, Wilkinson, as a member of the first committee, was basically reheating an argument that he had served earlier to the committee. His idea received a polite response, but was quickly set aside. In its place, many divines, while not favoring a full definition in the title, suggested that the title could make an opening theological statement of some kind. Thomas Gadaker, for example, wanted the title to exclude any sense of justification by an inherent righteousness. This anti-Roman polemic could be effected by changing the committee's title of the justification of a man in the sight of God to the justification of a sinner in the sight of God, indicating that the person being justified as a sinner was not inherently righteous. That only altered one word in the title, and William Googe was open to the idea. But others, such as Richard Herrick, argued that man and sinner are interchangeable terms, and the change would simply not be useful. Members of the first committee responded then to this, as was the common practice. They now responded to these comments. Thomas Coleman spoke for the committee and suggested that "of a sinful man" might be a good compromise. Joshua Hoyle tried not to encourage the debate at all and simply reintroduced the committee's changed the title. The committee had recommended the addition of the phrase "in the sight of God" to the original "in the sight of God" to the original title because it was scriptural language used by Paul. Stanley Gower quickly took that argument and applied it to the previous debate. Since Paul used the word "man" and not "sinner," the assembly should use the word "man." Richard Vines acknowledged the wisdom of Gower, and the divines rejected Gadaker's anti-popish proposal. Now, the number of participants in the debate swelled quickly, and it soon became evident that the real need in the new title was not a little more anti-popery, but a little more anti-antinomianism. It was Thomas Hodges who first brought up the antinomian issue, and he speaks throughout the discussion as an expert on antinomian opinions. His own connections with antinomians have proved to be strong. In recent archival work, it was showed to be the case that Thomas Hodges actually used to be an antinomian, so he was qualified. Objecting to the phrase "in the sight of God," Hodges reminded the assembly that some, that is the antinomians, hold that God sees no sin in his children. They will make some advantage of this expression. Although the phrase was a biblical one in the sight of God, in 1643 it had become almost the private property of antinomians, and Hodges implied that the assembly should certainly avoid it. Another concern with the title was raised by Lazarus Seaman. The proposed title not only failed to clarify whether a God really saw sin in his people, it also failed to specify a temporal reference point for justification. Of a sinner, or a man in the sight of God, is an ambiguous expression because it doth not determine whether you mean an actual or an intentional justification. The title of the article could refer to a justification in eternity, say, or a justification that occurred simultaneously with Christ's satisfaction or atonement on the cross, the justification of Christ. In either case, the role of faith, if that were the whole story, the role of faith would not be genuinely instrumental in justification. Rather, faith recognizes an existing justification in the believer, which was, in the 17th century, a distinctly antinomian concept. Now, the idea of an eternal justification was the intellectual starting point for a number of key tenets of antinomianism. For antinomians, redemption is so tightly locked up in eternity that no events in time can touch it, including a man or a woman's own sin. And it's for that reason that sin does not affect the relationship between God the Father and his children. And it's for that reason that many antinomians refused to pray the Lord's Prayer, because it had the petition, "Forgive us our trespasses." Seaman's concern about the timing of justification in the history of redemption was recognized to be a weighty matter by others in Henry VII's chapel. Francis Taylor addressed one half of that concern and advanced the substitution of the words "before God" instead of the committee's phrase "in the sight of God." The tactic of boycotting scriptural language popular among antinomians was insufficient for Hodges, who had clarified his concern just a moment ago. As he saw it, the antinomians argued that God sees the sin of his people neither in the eye of his justice, which is an acceptable proposition about the economic trinity, but nor even in the eye of his omniscience, which is a heretical ontological point. And Hodges moved that the title should end with the words "before God's tribunal." Now, after a variety of other proposals, Dr. Peter Smith seemed to give the final word when he stated that justification cannot well be understood otherwise than of actual justification. And so it is set out very well. For the title, no reason to alter the title. But then he advocated the alteration proposed by Taylor. "I like it well to say, before God." Later in the day, the report and its recommendations were recommitted, but it was Taylor's proposal that was ultimately adopted by the assembly. Looking back even on this debate over the title, highly abbreviated, we can see that literary conventions about confessional titles and structures govern part of the debate, some wanting lengthy descriptive titles, others arguing for more conventional, brief, and general headings. The divines were not united about these conventions or about the necessity of using scriptural language to express a doctrinal truth. But most did seem to be in agreement, at least in principle, in opposing popery, and especially antinomianism. And in fact, in this instance, discourse about the use of scriptural language in the title is almost entirely subservient to the more fundamental theological and polemical concerns before the assembly. Now, debate over the title had occupied most of the morning session, but when the recommended title was recommitted, Dr. Joshua Hoyle placed the committee's second alteration before the gathering. Instead of reading, "We are accompted righteous before God," the new opening line of the article, as you can see in your handout, would provide a definition of justification that consisted of two component parts. "We are justified," that is, we are accounted righteous before God and have remission of sins. Although the title of Article 11 had been shelved, the issues raised during the debate persisted, and Seaman's concern for an actual justification in the experience of a Christian is the first issue discussed when Hoyle finished explaining the committee's reasons for the second alteration. As Dr. Thomas Temple explained, we need not put actual in the title, but it was still fit to make some addition to the article in respect of the antinomians, and to make some difference betwixt seeing of sin and imputing of sin. George Walker countered that the entire discussion was superfluous, since justification, by definition, is actual, that is to say, an occurrence in time. But simply announcing that justification was genuine certainly did not solve Seaman's concern, which was the lack of an explicit declaration of temporal justification in the life of the believer. Walker appears to have realized this after a bit and declared that something needed to be inserted in the article to show when he was justified. This was all that Seaman wanted. In his mind, the committee's definition of justification seems to hold out that the use of faith is only to apprehend that which is already done, which doth entirely jump with the opinions of the antinomians. The man is justified before he repents and believes. Dr. Temple and Richard Vines appear to have agreed with Seaman, and Vine carries on by arguing the difference between faith apprehending an accomplished satisfaction and faith apprehending an accomplished justification. As Seaman saw it, the antinomians conflated either the covenant of redemption or the accomplishment of redemption with the application of redemption, to use early modern terminology. And they did this to combat Arminianism. Like the mainstream Reformed Orthodox, antinomians opposed any Arminian understanding of faith that made it a new work in the covenant of grace, a form of legalism or gnomism. But most antinomians combated Arminianism by positing a justification in eternity, and therefore a justification without faith, and faith to be only a manifestation of justification, in the words of one divine. Thus, antinomianism had a soteriological component in addition to its well-known legal component, from which it derives its name. Quite possibly, some of those labeled as antinomian by the assembly may not have had any anti-legal component in their thinking at all. The assembly's own petition to Parliament about antinomians, which was delivered a month prior to this debate, admitted that the authors and preachers that they wished to interrogate deviated from orthodoxy in different degrees. This petition also illustrates that there were not only different degrees and strains of English antinomians, but also different aspects of thinking within antinomianism. The particular kind of antinomianism which concerned the assembly during its debates about justification was distinct from that which occupied the divines during their debates over the moral law and in the gathering's first petition to Parliament. In the petition, the Commons was informed about the many false opinions and dangerous consequences against the seventh article especially. If you know your articles, that's the article about the Old Testament and the moral law. Those concerns were related to the fundamental doctrines of free grace, justification by faith in Christ, and of sanctification. But the chief problem was that the antinomian authors, quote, expressly undermined, though in different degrees, the moral law of God in all parts thereof, and discouraged good Christians from humiliation for sin and these sad times wherein God calls us to that duty above all other. So their concern then is about the law, and about civil disturbances caused by antinomians who will not fast because they think that repentance of that sort does not belong in the Christian life. According to the divines, the antinomians were in very many places of the kingdom, but chiefly in and about the city. So for many divines, it appears that the antinomians in London loomed larger than papists in Madrid. And it's not unimportant that the minutes of the assembly record more than twice as many references to antinomians as to papists, which is their accepted term of reference for Roman Catholics. It's certainly significant that the divines never petitioned Parliament to pass tough measures against Roman Catholics, but it frequently petitioned against antinomians, and the Synod's Antinomianism Committee was one of its most active. The Assembly's anti-antinomianism was not only a byproduct of a theoretical or historical aversion of orthodoxy to Munster-like lawlessness. The Assembly's mood and actions were in this instance triggered by immediate contextual factors. While legal forms of antinomianism were doctrinally distinct from soteriological forms, they were psychologically inseparable. And the anti-antinomianism that fueled debate over the law also infused additional tension into the debates over justification, a debate which became preoccupied with what I term soteriological antinomianism. Now, perhaps sensing that the Assembly's deliberations would not proceed in an orderly fashion, Herbert Palmer, as was his wont, moved to recommit the committee's report on the 11th article. This irritated Charles Hurl, who defended the committee's report on the 11th article, and made a humble motion that no man offer a reappeal except he offer something to stand instead. Five divines immediately offered something to stand instead, until Thomas Gadaker abruptly announced that after these debates, he desired to speak a word concerning that which is inserted in the former part, remission of sins. And then, without waiting at all, he promptly launched into a lengthy address about the definition of justification itself, and the question of antinomianism was, for a little while, left behind. The committee had proposed a definition of justification in the opening lines of the revised article, which comprised a person being accounted righteous and having the remission of sins. And Gadaker was the first to stand and raise a major objection to the committee's proposed definition of justification. Members of the committee had, according to Gadaker, diversely explained remission as something antecedent to justification or as a branch or part of justification. But in the French and Belgic confessions, Olivianus, Piscator, and other theologians, Gadaker says that justification is a synonym with remission for sins. Now, usually the role of Reformed authors is called in a speaker's support. Here, Gadaker announced that they were all wrong, because remission of sins is a thing distinct from justification. Sins are remitted for the merit of Christ, and the blessing of remission doth always accompany justification, but it is no part of justification. Gadaker's first proof was philological. Justify, in no language, signifies to remit, pardon, or forgive. In our English, it rather signifies the contrary, to defend or to declare a man righteous. His comment about English usage of the term merely illustrates its correspondence with more significant languages, Latin, Greek, and Hebrew. No classical author understands justify as remit. Only in the Vulgate does the case obtain, and those who have meddled with it. More significantly, Greek and Hebrew authors, classical and biblical, do not understand justify to remit. It means the opposite. In the scriptures, justify ordinarily means that a man is declared just in a judicial sense, or, less often, Gadaker says, morally, to make a man habitually just. While the latter was certainly a controversial statement, Gadaker was almost certainly intending it to be an etymological rather than a theological observation, for his entire speech, both in structure and in content, closely parallels his preaching on the subject of justification, which he had finished a few years before on Romans 3, verse 28. And at that time, after tabulating the etymology of justification, Gadaker had explicitly stated an exegetical rule that etymology, however important, is not a sound basis for determining the meaning of a word, but its actual or ordinary use in the text is useful. Either way, Gadaker concludes, one cannot substitute remission or forgiveness for justification and make sense of the biblical text. Gadaker's second argument was theological, and it had to do with his understanding of the nature of justification itself, summed up in his maxim, to justify is an act of justice. To pardon is an act of favor of justice. Let me say that again. To justify is an act of justice. To pardon is an act of favor of justice. In Gadaker's mind, forgiveness prior to justification trumps justice. It makes the jury and the judge irrelevant. As Gadaker sees it, forgiveness and reconciliation flow from justification as benefits of it. To be justified is to not be guilty and nothing more. The first to respond to Gadaker was his old nemesis, George Walker. Gadaker and Walker had sustained a semi-private feud on the topic that ran for 30 years before disintegrating into an all-out pamphlet war in 1641. In the process, Walker had accused Gadaker of something approaching heresy, and William Googe, an unfortunate witness to the whole event, of injustice and partiality, and the exchange finally exhausted itself in 1642 when Gadaker fell ill and the names of all three men appeared on early lists of divines nominated to the assembly. Walker commented on the great deal of learning showed and agreed that remission of sins may in some sense be a consequence of justification. Unfortunately, the scribe's record of Walker's speech is somewhat confused, as a number of interlineations and erasures indicate. Walker ends his speech by explaining the relationship between justification and union with Christ. God, by that Spirit, by which he doth unite us unto Christ, he doth work faith in us and makes us new creatures. And he goes on. And in spite of the complexity of the record at this point, it appears that Walker is willing to distinguish between remission of sins and justification, at least for the sake of argument, because he sees both, to employ a term profitably used by Mark Garcia, as either aspects or products of union with Christ. I think he thinks in terms of aspects of union with Christ. Now, Gadaker withstood a sustained attack on his position for the remainder of the morning, and the main body of the assembly was divided between a handful who, like Piscator and Olivianus, equated forgiveness with justification, such as Richard Vines, and the majority who included forgiveness within the definition of justification, but also saw in justification the imputation of the righteousness of Christ. They saw it as a two-part thing. Everyone tried to convince Gadaker that forgiveness was, indeed, an essential component of justification. Gadaker had actually changed his opinion on the matter in middle age, and one of his former students from Cambridge, Joshua Hoyle, found himself leading the assault on his old teacher. Hoyle provided a point-by-point rebuttal of Gadaker's speech and mentioned scriptural texts that did connect justification to forgiveness, which took some unpacking. And Gadaker responded sharply to Hoyle, but really only reasserted his main arguments. Old Mr. Wilkinson, framing his comments in a pious rather than a polemical tone, argued for the committee's definition of justification and argued against any sense of justification that may involve an infused rather than imputed righteousness, which wasn't really quite to the point. When Twist finally spoke from his raised platform, it was he who linked the earlier discussion of antinomianism with the later attempt to define justification. We had need to take heed of opposing the antinomians, lest we make Camier an antinomian, and many others. Of course, the many others included himself, who confidently placed justification in eternity, or William Pemble, the friend, who placed justification solely on the cross. After the prolocutor's comments, the divines heeded Palmer's earlier motion to recommit the report, because the morning was over. Now, it's obvious by this point that there are many divines participating in this debate, many of which are relatively unknown. One concomitant to an ecclesiologically dominated history of the assembly has been the dominance of a certain set of characters, such as Stephen Marshall, Edmund Calamy, Thomas Goodwin, Philip Nye, Samuel Rutherford. Even this brief narrative brings a crowd of names to the stage. And the assembly's deliberations over justification, we find, are dominated by some of the oldest, best educated men in the assembly. Joshua Hoyle is a significant scholar and teacher in Dublin, closely associated with James Usher. Hoyle had preached through the whole of scriptures, lectured through almost all of the scriptures, and had lectured against the entire corpus of Bellarmine. Thomas Gadaker is a prolific writer, difficult to categorize within post-Reformation orthodoxy. George Walker embarked on the production of a major system of theology, a number of volumes which were published, and then unfortunately he was let out of jail and had to go back to preaching. Herbert Palmer is known as a catechist. He's also a major theologian in the assembly's eyes. Richard Vines and Lazarus Seaman are known as Cambridge masters. When it came to a discussion of justification, the assembly was letting these men take center stage. And notably, of the theologians in this group, only Vines has received any scholarly attention, and very little at that. Gadecker's speech, hot on the 5th of September, was tepid by the 6th. John Green in the morning requested a statement on the certainty or assurance of salvation and on the perseverance of the saints, but was notified that would be addressed in Article 16 of Sin After Baptism and in 17 of Predestination and Election. Only Theodore Bathurst was interested in continuing the discussion about remission of sins, but he could not force open the debate. The morning of the 6th also revealed that although the first committee's report had been recommitted, the committee did not appear to have changed anything except the title. Instead of the antinomian sounding in the sight of God, the committee's new title read, Of the Justification of Man Before God. It was quickly approved, and Dr. William Googe formally reintroduced the committee's recommended definition of justification, which was unchanged and involved both accounting a person righteous and the forgiveness of sins. Then Dr. Daniel Featley opened the day's debates. Whereas the previous session's debate had focused on the addition of the clause remission of sins as a part of justification, this morning the first half of the definition was called into question. We are justified, that is, we are accounted righteous. Portions of Featley's speech appear in Lightfoot's journal and in the minutes, and the full text of Featley's speech was published in Sacronemesis and later as an appendix to Dipper's Dipped. That's a book against Anabaptists. After distinguishing between three different types of righteousness, Featley proposed a definition of justification and showed how certain words and clauses were designed to refute libertines, antinomians, Socinians, Arminians, and papists. He then segued into a catalog of theologians who allegedly held to his doctrine of justification prior to the Reformation. Featley's lengthy speech, which had all the trappings of a one-man committee report, was virtually ignored by the other speakers. The next hour produced a tangled give and take with attempts to defend or to criticize the committee's formula and to define justification with a view to excluding the erring views of sectarians, papists, and a few fellow divines. But throughout all of its wanderings, the debate always comes back to the phrase accounting of a person as righteous. The previous day, Gadecker had stood alone. But now, as the topic shifted to a new issue, opposition to the committee began to grow. Richard Vines, for example, rose to say that it will be safe for us to speak according to the word of God, again using the language of Scripture in service of a larger argument. He acknowledged that it was proper to speak of accounting someone righteous, but he preferred what he considered a more biblical phrase, be made righteous. The minutes record that 10 prominent men sided with the committee against the troika of critics, Gadecker, Vines, and Francis Woodcock. Gadecker pointed out that the language of being accounted righteous could as easily refer to sanctification, he said, as to justification, and he instanced Luke 1, verse 6, where this language is used and more obviously refers to sanctification or holiness of life than it does to justification. Vines went so far as to say that we are righteous and then reputed so and then declared. But the rest of the divines were convinced that the trio was confusing not only justification and sanctification, but also, as Herbert Palmer was impolite enough to say, us and the papists. To the repeated objection to Gadecker and his friends that accounting righteous did not equate justification, the committee men replied that the whole of the Article 11 defined justification, not simply that one phrase. But here as elsewhere, the committee is not above defending the report with some casual hyperbole. The remainder of the article, in point of fact, touches only on the way in which and on the basis on which sinners are justified, and not on a definition of justification itself. Only Joshua Hoyle was able to step back from the thick of the debate to observe that the part of the definition of justification that Gadecker and Vines and Woodcock were objecting to was original to the article and not an innovation of the committee at all, save that it was more explicitly linked to justification in its revised form. At the end of the day, the accounting of sinners as righteous was far too theologically, historically, and polemically significant for the majority in the assembly to reach any compromise with the three. As Hoyle reminded his fellow divines, consider when this article was made and against whom. About the end of the Council of Trent and against the papists. And it was indeed a fundamental article of Protestantism. And when it came to a vote, the assembly as a whole decided with Hoyle that God, by esteeming us righteous, doth make us righteous, and rejected the idea that God esteems us or accounts us as righteous because we are made righteous in ourselves through sanctification alone. The puzzle of some Reformed divines advocating what's arguably and was argued to be a more Roman Catholic than Protestant position on justification is perhaps solved by John Lightfoot, whose opinions are not recorded in the minutes, but are recorded in his own journal. He opposed the committee for two reasons. Number one, because we speak less in this phrase, accounting righteous, than in the word justified. And two, because this word accounted lieth very open to the antinomian opinion of eternal justification. Therefore, I desired it might have been read thus, we are made and accounted righteous, but being put to the question, it was carried otherwise. So concern over antinomianism had risen to such a pitch that a handful of divines, Lightfoot included, were willing to sacrifice soteriological clarity on the anti-Catholic polemic on the altar of anti-antinomianism. It may also be the case, it seems to me, that the assembly did not give scholars like Gadicker sufficient time to explain the mechanics of their position on justification. Gadicker was incapable of brevity, but when he was free to expound his views at his own pace in his sermons or in his writings, the distinctions between his own understanding of justification and sanctification and the different Roman Catholic understandings of the same are clearly delineated. And Gadicker did allow that some differences between Catholics and Reformed were only semantic, but he still held that there were substantive differences between the doctrines of Rome and the Reformers. Now, although his views are certainly not unique, it's only George Walker at this point in the debate who expresses concern with both sides of the debate and some of their phrases and statements. It appears he felt that Joshua Hoyle's and the committee's unqualified statements about imputation didn't really reckon with the concern of the committee's critics, that there be some necessary correspondence between justification and sanctification, a correspondence that was allegedly missing in the life of and thought of antinomians. God's judgment, Walker says, is always according to truth. And if God doth account us so, we are made so. But he did not think that that entailed an infused righteousness in the believer as a part of justification. Rather, as we are made sin by Adam, so righteous by Christ. We are made righteous by communion of Christ's righteousness, and the ground of this is our union with Christ. During one debate, where only two alternatives are being vocalized, either infusion or imputation of righteousness, Walker blurts out, it's an imperfect division to say that to justify is either by inherency or verbum forense, for there is justification by communion of the righteousness of Christ. Walker's own soteriological solution, inherited from Calvin and presumably the Apostle Paul, was the believer's union with Christ. And he writes more on this subject than most of the Westminster divines. Perhaps he repeats his position as many times in this debate as he does in his published works, since the scribe begins to record only his name and not his speeches, an apparent act of censorship that he extends to very few during the debate. 10 additional speeches followed Walker's before the committee's second revision passed. The gathering's debate over justification continued for days. Some of the committee's recommendations were approved quickly. Other proposals required days of debate. Such was the case when the divines debated the imputation of the act of obedience of Christ, a discussion which involved Christology and the atonement and justification, bringing them together, as Robert Lethem has argued very profitably, should often be done. Certainly, of these loci approved inseparable at the Westminster Assembly, and the revisions of the 11th article, dominated by discussion of the imputation of the act of obedience of Christ, continued until the 19th of September. Now, I think even this brief study suggests a number of conclusions. First, the study shows that a fresh cast of characters comes to the fore when the scene is theological rather than ecclesiological. William Bridge, John Lightfoot, Stephen Marshall, Thomas Young, Philip Nye, Edmund Calamy, Jeremiah Whittaker suddenly appear during the ecclesiological debate. But where are they? Where are they during the theological debates? Some were absent, most were present, but chose to let others speak. An additional group of divines does participate in the justification debate, but much less than they do in a comparable segment of an ecclesiological debate. I believe the last page in your handout has a comparison table between a couple weeks of justification debate and a couple weeks of ecclesiological debate. And it shows that different characters come to the fore. So the opposite trend also obtains, as you can see, when you compare 2 weeks of the justification debate with 2 weeks of an ecclesiological debate. At least 16 divines show much more interest in theology than ecclesiology. Do these same people play major roles in other theological debates at the assembly? It seems probable that personal expertise or perceptions of expertise would determine participation in debates over a range of theological loci. Second, there is the matter of parties. Divisions in the assembly emerge which do not follow traditional ecclesiological fault lines. For example, when defining justification, there are three parties: those who equate justification with remission of sins, those who add to remission the imputation of righteousness, and Gattaker, who's a party to himself and equates justification with vindication. When later discussing the basis of justification, the crowd divides along different lines than those held at the beginning part of the debate. The line divides between those who hold to the position of Anselm and his Christology and those who adopt a post-Reformation formulation and reject his Christology. Either way, it's apparent that an ecclesiological taxonomy of the assembly does not help a theologian or historian to understand the assembly's theological debates. It so happens that during 1 week of the justification debate, that every person who held to Anselm's understanding of the atonement was also a Presbyterian, and that a subset of these were probably modified Episcopalians or modified Presbyterians at heart. But these theologians are opposed by the independent Thomas Goodwin, the Episcopalian Daniel Featley, and the majority of the other Presbyterians. If Presbyterian is relevant at all as a category to this debate, it must be so as a larger tendency towards a respect for the church fathers and a caution in reforming the theology of the Reformation. That is to say, Presbyterianism could be a possible indicator of yet another divide, such as a traditionalist versus a reformist tendency at the assembly, and perhaps in the clerical community at large. Third, the difficulty of understanding the persons and parties of the assembly points to the complexity of the codification process in the post-Reformation period. Edmund Calamy once argued that the great work that the Lord requireth was to bring the English church back not only to our first Reformation in King Edward's days, but to reform the Reformation itself. But Calamy was no bold theological reformer, and nor were most of the other divines who struggled for half a morning over the change of wording in a title, let alone the addition or removal of entire articles from the 39 articles. It's not simply the ambiguity of the synod's mandate, because Parliament actually is very unclear about whether it's legal for the assembly to make major adjustments to the 39 articles. Part of the problem is the creative task itself that made reform of the 39 articles difficult. The task is theological, exegetical, it's linguistic, it's pastoral, it's polemical, rhetorical, historical. Of course, the gathering had a political cause, it had a political end, but the assembly's debate over justification, and its other debates, I'd argue as well, cannot be understood apart from the intellectual arguments that are advanced
by the committees and the individual divines. Fourth, the study indicates that pressures from without the walls of the abbey could be felt within keenly by the divines. The most obvious external pressure on the assembly at this point, it comes from the sectaries, chiefly the antinomians. What's a little surprising is the perceived nature of that threat. Although the pastoral and social effects of antinomianism are important, in this debate, the antinomian enemy is understood in theological terms, and in fairly subtle theological terms at that. Undoubtedly, there is a spillover between civil and soteriological antinomianism, between legal and soteriological antinomianism, but it's the latter that chiefly concerns these divines. Nevertheless, at the end of the day, the antinomians of London affected the debates of the assembly, but not much of the text itself. The assembly's revision of the 11th article expressed a standard post-Reformation treatment of justification. So too does the assembly's 11th chapter on justification in the Confession of Faith. The majority, on the one hand, the majority of the divines were unwilling to give any ground to the prolocutor, who held some key antinomian tenets. But on the other hand, the assembly only changes the title of the 11th article to please the extreme anti-antinomian lobby. Fifthly, this debate illustrates the usefulness of background knowledge of a corporately formed confession. As Quentin Skinner has argued, context does not determine the meaning of a text, but it is useful for adjudicating between different possible meanings of a text. When the Westminster Divines finally abandoned the 39 articles and wrote a new confession, they include in their chapter of justification a section condemning eternal justification. The debate we've just looked at clarifies exactly what sort of eternal justification they're worried about and why they're worried about it. It's because of the seriously consistent application of a justification in eternity on the part of many alleged antinomian divines. Also, this debate, I think, is useful as a sort of court of appeal for assessing different possible meanings of words like justification. We know what sort of justification they have in view here, and we know just what sort of concept of eternal justification they have in view. The primary focus of Westminster Confession of Faith 11.4 is the disastrously consistent antinomians, and not the similar but more sensible views of, say, William Twiss, or obviously the variations of eternal justification that develop in Dutch theology in the 19th century. In conclusion, the justification debate, I think, furthers our understanding of the assembly, especially the interplay between the radical fringe in the Civil War and the process of theological codification. The divines' debates on doctrine can only be understood when the history of the Civil War and the history of theology are brought together as they were at the Synod itself, and only by looking beyond the usual parties and categories of the Westminster Assembly and its usual historiography can we identify new issues and new persons worthy of fresh research. Thank you.